With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
So is this the introduction?
It might be.
Hello and welcome to the Renaissance English History Podcast. I'm your host, but I have two co-hosts today.
Wow, co-hosts. Guests, perhaps?
Guests.
We'll go with co-hosts. We'll take responsibility for
You've
this.
Actually heard their voices before they did a podcast on Richard III recently.
Now is the... Actually, Xander did that one.
Oh, yeah. Now is the winter of our discontent made... glorious summer by this son of York.
Oh, yeah. What a guy.
What a cool guy, buddy.
So anyway, that's Xander, and I'm Eric, and we're the guys from Reconsider, where we do politics, but not the thinking for you.
And so today what we're going to talk about is reconsidering some of the basic, what do you think?
Narratives
of Tudor England. And we're going to talk about some... women in particular, and some stories that people get very excited about and very emotional about, and how we can go back and examine where we get our own thoughts from and examine how we feel about the things we read and how to reconsider things.
And if you happen to like this episode, Heather is going to join us on Reconsider, and we're going to basically do the exact opposite, use Tudor England history to reconsider modern-day events. So, stay tuned.
Plugs for that, so head on over to their site, and I'll post links.
Reconsidermedia.com/podcast, or find us on iTunes at Reconsider. We're Agora Buddies. You can find us that way, too.
Agora Buddies.
We're great Agora Buddies.
So, how should we get this started, you guys?
So maybe we could start with a couple of the Reconsider principles as a framework, and then since... Heather knows, obviously, way more about the history than we do. We can talk about some of these narratives, and then Xander and I can talk about how some of the principles apply to understanding and disentangling some of those narratives.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Sort of the whole purpose of the Reconsider podcast and blog is, as the name implies, reconsidering existing political narratives, opinions that you might have, or that other people might have. So that is perhaps easier said than done. And I think
no, perhaps about it, buddy.
Yeah, sure thing, guy. We quote South Park more than is healthy.
They really like South Park quotes.
Yeah.
reconsidering is a concept that I think everyone wants to think that they believe in, but when it actually comes time to do it, is very challenging. I struggle with it, just as Eric does, just as I think everyone does. So we put together a couple of reconsider principles to actually help you implement the practice of reconsidering. So. These are skepticism and detachment, and there are both internal and external varieties of skepticism and detachment.
We should make a 2x2 matrix of them.
Ooh.
Yeah, put that online. A grid of some sort.
Eric was a consultant.
I was a consultant. We love 2x2 matrices. Matrixes?
Matrices?
Anyway, so let's talk about skepticism first. So skepticism is the idea that when you look at something, either... internally or externally. We'll start with externally because it's simpler. Mm-hmm. When you read something and it says such and such a thing is true. Mm-hmm. Skepticism is the idea of saying in your head, I wonder if that's true. Mm-hmm. And how would I know it's true? How would I confirm that it's true? Mm-hmm. As opposed to either accepting something gleefully because it matches the narrative you like, or rejecting something outright because it's against the narrative you like. So skepticism isn't just about rejection. Mm-hmm. It's about saying, I wonder how I would know that this is true. Mm-hmm. Much harder is internal skepticism, which is when you have an idea about what's true, in particular a narrative, you know, such and such policy is good for such and such people, or something like that, it's particularly hard to recognize that that is a narrative as opposed to an immutable part of, you know, life or immutable fact, and be equally skeptical about that. So challenging yourself and saying, how do I know that's true?
So, like, if I were going to say something, I'm trying to think about specific facts that there are questions about, like, the princess in the tower. Did Richard III murder the princess in the tower?
Great example.
Or was it Margaret Beaufort, or was it somebody else? So when I read Richard III murdered the princess in the tower, perhaps I can be a little bit, well, how would I know that that was true?
Right. And if you're not being skeptical, you're more likely to either say, oh, yeah, he totally did it. What a bad guy. Mm-hmm. Or like, no, he wouldn't do it. That's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
And so as soon as you take a side on that before mm-hmm. you've gone to gather facts, mm-hmm. you've failed to be skeptical.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I think that's more, well, that's an example of both of kind of external, internal somewhat. Mm. Certainly questioning narratives that you read in history as you investigate them is a form of external skepticism. I think internal skepticism would be if you consume a new narrative and your emotional reaction is almost immediate, you become defensive, and it's something that I think if you start paying attention and looking for it, you actually start noticing a lot more frequently.
Mm.
That's often a clue that you're not digesting information in an unbiased way. And that doesn't mean that you are wrong. It means that it might be a clue to start reconsidering one of your positions. There might be some cognitive biases at work. You might be anchored towards one sort of idea that influences a larger narrative that you believe in. So that would be an example of encountering or something that could encourage you to use internal skepticism. So the other two ideas are detachment, external detachment, internal detachment. I think internal detachment is much easier.
Mm.
That is, I'm a person, I think I'm a good person, I have ideas, but I'm willing to change my ideas. My ideas define who I am to a degree, but not really. I can see myself outside of certain narratives that I hold, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's much harder to do for other people, I think, because if you run into someone at a cocktail party, have a conversation with them, the stories that you hear from them in that 30 minutes largely defines your perspective of them. So it's very hard to detach who an individual is from the ideas that they're presenting. But if you can do this, that lets you, one, approach the ideas as ideas
mm-hmm.
and not approach the ideas as potential animosity mm-hmm. towards an individual. And it lets you maintain the conversation with that individual because you say, okay, this person is probably a good person. I really disagree about this mm-hmm. one thing that they are carrying in their mm-hmm. mind. And maybe there are other things we can agree on. Maybe we can find some common ground.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and attaching someone's identity to their ideas, since we'll never have a true view of their identity, makes us more likely to treat them as a stereotype. So for example, if you hear someone believes in like very free market policies, you might be like, oh, I bet they're really rich and they're selfish and they just want, mm. you know, they don't want to pay their workers more or something
right.
like that. And then what you do, since you've painted that stereotype, you say, and therefore, of course, they're wrong.
Right.
And so you're not able to engage the idea for the idea. Or in the opposite direction, someone may be for, you know, new labor laws or regulation or expanded mm-hmm. welfare. And maybe that's them saying like, well, they're selfish and they don't want to work hard and they mm-hmm. want the government to pay for them and
mm-hmm.
they're lazy. And therefore, they're obviously wrong. And you're not able to look at those policies for those policies.
What about, I mean, this is very valuable, and especially at the time that we're in right now, recording just before the Electoral College is going to vote for whoever they're going to vote for.
Which, by the way, one of the weird things is, I never thought in my life that I would say that. That, like, oh yeah, it's right before the Electoral College meets and decides who's going to be president.
I know, right?
What? Anyway, huh? That's for another time.
But like, there's so much emotional at stake. I feel like both sides in the U.S. election and even with Brexit, like there's this idea, and this gets way past Tudor history, but I feel like part of it is because of the animosities between religious groups that we saw in Tudor England
mm-hmm.
With, you know, Catholics and Protestants and extreme versions of Protestants and all of that. It's like your belief in the fact that you were okay with voting for Trump, the fact that you are a Protestant, the fact that you believe in the transubstantiation or not, says XYZ, I can extrapolate this stuff about you. And therefore, it's like this whole judgment, or the fact that you voted for Hillary, or the fact whoever you voted for, like, it must mean this. So how do you detach from that?
I think it's
And how do you detach from that, like, with history? Like, if you're reading Henry VIII killed his wives, or if you're reading, you know, Mary killed hundreds of Protestants in the Book of Martyrs, and that's where propaganda and stuff comes in too, right? So right. Fox's Book of Martyrs, which was the book that made her famous as Bloody Mary. Right. So, like, talk to me about how you detach from that.
Yeah, practically, if I'm looking at my own interpretation of contemporary events, I'm coming from a place where I want to understand as much as possible. I want to have as accurate an understanding of reality as possible. And I recognize that all humans, including myself, are born and carry with them cognitive biases. Mm-hmm. And I know that one of the things that can help you overcome cognitive biases, and there's been a lot of work on this done, you can read Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow, good book. One of the ways to overcome cognitive biases is recognize that you have them and check for them on a constant basis, right? Mm-hmm. So if I feel very emotional about something, just asking, okay, is this a reasonable emotional reaction? Mm-hmm. You know, on average, that will contribute to your having a better interpretation of reality than if you didn't do that, right?
Now, so this is a good pro tip for how to get through Christmas dinner.
It's yes.
Totally true, yeah.
Crazy Uncle Joe, right?
Right.
Which, by the way, Joe thinks you're crazy niece or nephew, you know, Bobby.
Yeah.
Right?
Of course.
Now, as it relates to historical figures, I think if we're going to use the term external detachment for this one, it serves a different purpose than if you're talking to someone, because part of the reason you want to detach a person from their ideas is so you can maintain the conversation. Mm-hmm. You're not going to have a conversation with Henry VIII. He's long gone, right?
Right.
But I think looking at a figure that is as controversial as Henry VIII, who is frequently remembered for his six wives, for this being this, you know, indulgent character who really only cared about eating and womanizing and all that, the way that detachment can be useful for a character like that in history is it gives you a pause to say, okay, well, obviously this king of England was more complex than this one particular narrative can be used to describe him with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's one example of how I think it can help approach history.
I see.
And the way I think skepticism can help there is not so much about the facts, because Henry did have, I mean, it's almost certainly true, and we don't have any evidence to the contrary, that Henry did kill some of his wives.
Mm-hmm.
And we have plenty of evidence that under Mary, Protestants were killed as part of the, you know, suppression or the war. Mm-hmm. But some contextuals, what we need to be skeptical about is not whether those facts are true, but what we conclude from them.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, like, Bloody Mary is the thing that we need to be skeptical about, because we kind of go like, well, you know, what was going on contextually? And, like, obviously from our modern standards, like, the idea of killing people based on the religion is obscene. But, for example, my understanding is that, like, Elizabeth may have killed, or under Elizabeth, her administration killed more Catholics than Mary killed Protestants.
Yeah,
and when you know that, how does that change your narrative? Do you go like, oh, is it Bloody Mary and Bloody Elizabeth? Or do you start going like, maybe this is just what was going on at the time?
And then also, I guess this would go for current events too, just looking at the biases of the person who's writing the account. So much of what we know about Mary is written through John Fox and his Book of Martyrs, and he was an exiled Protestant who definitely had an axe to grind against Mary. And so looking at, like, okay, well, maybe those facts aren't even completely true, and maybe it was, you know, this guy exaggerated some stuff or made some stuff sound a lot worse than it was or something like that. So is that, I guess, what would you say about that with skeptics? Like, even with facts, maybe aren't necessarily even true.
Yeah, I think we maybe touched on this a bit when we talked about Richard III, but obviously there is propaganda in history, and who tells stories matters, right? I mean, we talked about a particular historian named Victor, who usually ends up writing the history, and that matters because people who end up winning want to have a certain interpretation of their own experience remembered by other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, and so that when you see that potential for bias, it causes you to be a little more skeptical. You cannot be, like, infinitely skeptical of all things. You cannot do all the research on all the things.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to sort of, like, use that resource selectively. And seeing something where you go like, maybe this person had an axe to grind. Maybe this person had an agenda. Mm-hmm. Is a useful way of being skeptical. Not necessarily outright dismissing them.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But going to gather more information to start to, and that's, again, skepticism as opposed to dismissal, It's about, like, I need to know more about this before I draw a conclusion.
It's interesting. I could see you going down, like, a big rabbit hole of, like, okay, well, what were John Fox's, reasons for this? Okay, well, what about the people who wrote about John Fox? What were their reasons for writing about it? Well, what were their, you know, and if you, as you go longer through 500 years, suddenly you've got, you know, Victorian historians had a very different view of history than of Tudor England than we do. And, you know, that's where people, I mean, I guess I wonder, there's this whole term revisionist history.
Mm.
Like, tell me what you guys think about that.
Well, first I want to just, I think you make a really interesting point, which is you can go down that rabbit hole, right? Mm-hmm. And if you go down deep enough, then you have a PhD thesis topic, right? Right. I mean, that is what people, like professional academic historians, write about, mm-hmm. is one strange source's interpretation of one particular event. And that's mm-hmm. how we further knowledge, right?
Mm-hmm.
Revisionist history, I think, is a bit of a loaded phrase in this work, because a lot of the times, I don't think it's inherently a bad concept if you're mm-hmm. just talking about reviewing history
right.
and offering other narratives. But a lot of the times when people say revisionist, they're specifically referring to a body of work that mm-hmm. frequently puts forward a set of ideas that are kind of recurring and fit within a particular type of narrative. So it's not like reapproaching history from like a completely objective way. Mm-hmm. It usually has like a purpose or an objective built into it.
So then should we go through just a couple of these maybe narratives and you guys walk me through revising or reconsidering it?
Yes.
Yeah, we don't know the history so well, so this right. will actually be great for us as well. And we may ask some like probing questions about like, you know,
okay.
about some of these folks, yeah.
Okay, so Mary the First as Bloody Mary.
Yes.
Yes. So help me. So there's the narrative that Mary took over and she married Philip of Spain and she made England all Catholic again and she killed a whole bunch of Protestants and that was all she was kind of good for.
Mm.
Mm.
So the way I might get started is it's a very... The first thing that lights up for my external skepticism is it's a very short narrative.
Mm-hmm.
So what I don't know is how long was Mary's reign?
It was about 5 years.
5 years. Okay. So it's sort of like a presidential term.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's a good analogy, maybe not.
Mm.
So she's got about 5 years, and I'm assuming that it's fairly well-known fact that some Protestants died uh-huh. and that she married Philip II.
Yeah.
But during that 5 years, do we have some evidence of what else may have gone on during her reign?
Well, yeah, she initially started out, she did want to bring England back to the Catholic fold. She did want to do that. And initially she started out by saying that she just wanted to do it through education rather than forcing people. So she spent a lot of money actually on colleges and training priests and training new clergy because all the clergy were now trained in the more Protestant after 20 years of the Reformation, 25 years of the Reformation. So she wanted to train up some priests and train some colleges and stuff like that. So that was one of the first things she did. And she also stood very firmly in wanting to marry Philip. Like her counselors didn't want her to marry Philip because they were afraid of this foreign king taking over. And, you know, she was the first woman queen. She was the first queen that England had in the post-1066 period. So it was a new thing to have a queen and like what would happen when she got married. So there was like a lot of stuff trying to figure out like her role, like would he be the king? And she made a very stirring speech at the Guildhall. There was actually a riot, Wyatt's rebellion against her marriage because they were all afraid of Spanish, that there was going to be a Spanish king and that her children would be Spanish and suddenly Spain would be ruling England. And there was this rebellion that got all the way across London Bridge and she had to like get her forces to go fight them. And she gave this stirring speech at the Guildhall, which everybody said, and it was the forerunner to Elizabeth's famous speech to the Spanish Armada, you know, that you see from the movies where she says, I'm but a woman, but, you know, I have the body of a woman, but I'm a king and a king of England. And Mary basically said the same thing to her troops and rallied them. And the other thing that now I just think about, she was very good. People were very loyal to her. In the beginning, she had to fight off Lady Jane Grey, who was a Protestant, who she didn't actually want to be the queen, but Mary's brother Edward, who was a Protestant, when he died, he tried to change the succession so that his cousin Jane Grey, who was a Protestant, would be the queen, so that he basically tried to disinherit his sister. And there was a lot of political machinations in there, but Jane was in the tower ready to be crowned, and she reigned for 9 days, and Mary had to fight. So Mary had to gather troops and lead troops into London, and the people all fled. So Mary actually effectively put off 2 rebellions in that 5 years. So that's kind of something else that's interesting about her, that she was even in the midst of this narrative of her killing people and being a Catholic, and even England as a Protestant country was willing to fight for her through that. So I don't know, that's an interesting thing about her.
That's fascinating. So, I mean, starting from this narrative of just bloody killing a bunch of people, like, we're already adding complexity to it, right? Now, we talk about, or you talked about, how Mary was the first Queen of England. So the first thing that comes to my mind is she probably encountered quite a bit of resistance because people don't like new things, right? Mm-hmm. So another question that I would ask is what sort of political constraints and pressures existed at the time? How autocratic was the monarch in England at that mm-hmm. point in terms of having independence of power? And how much were, you know, all of her advisors and the aristocracy and the nobility pressuring her towards one action or another?
They were pressuring her mostly because she needed an heir. She was 37. And so that was, she didn't necessarily have a lot of pressure on her. She didn't need her nobles for foreign policy so much. She needed them for money. So anything that she wanted to do, they controlled the purse strings. So that was kind of what, but you know, something else about her reign is that it's actually quite tragic. She thought she was pregnant on 2 occasions. One time her doctors, at both times I think her doctors were sure, but one time it went all the way through 9 months. Everybody told her, you are pregnant, and she said she felt the baby quicken. And of course at the time there's no ultrasounds, there's no pregnancy tests, right? So her doctors were convinced, they said, yes, you are going to be pregnant, and you are pregnant. She went into confinement, you know, the public display, and you know, you think about women not being able to, even now it's hard with maternity leave and stuff like back then, she literally, women would go into confinement. So she would be 6 weeks before and 6 weeks after, just gone, only surrounded by women. Like, no men were allowed in.
Wow.
And so she went into confinement, and there was actually a rumor at one point that a son was born, and the bells pealed out, you know, through London, like, oh, there's a son, there's a prince, blah, 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 blah. And she just very quietly had to come back out because there was no son, there was no child. And it was considered a phantom pregnancy, is actually the word for when you want it so badly that you actually, your body makes these things happen. And there's just no baby. And that happened to her then a second time. And then she died probably of ovarian cancer, I think. Something like that. But it was... So there was that happening during this period as well, which was quite a tragic experience for her, I would think, considering that was also seen as a woman's number one job to have heirs. So she had this mixture on her of being both the monarch as well as the person who was supposed to produce the heirs. So, like, the kings didn't necessarily have to produce the heirs. They were just the monarch.
Right.
She had to be, which women nowadays who are working, I suppose, there's often that thing of that working women have to be both the breadwinner and take care of the home and stuff like that. And so she kind of had that very early on. She had to be both the monarch and go into confinement and have a child and stuff like that.
One of the questions I have about understanding, because the idea of Bloody Mary was that she was, like, very hardcore anti-Protestant, willing to kill people to, you know, to change England back, you know, ruthless, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, we've already talked about that she and Elizabeth killed a similar number of people, which doesn't mean she wasn't ruthless. It might have meant that Elizabeth also was. But, so when we think about post her 2 phantom pregnancies near her death, she knows that Elizabeth is set up to be her heir. So presumably she knows that when she dies, the Catholic dream is going to sort of die with her.
Yeah.
How did she react to that? How did she deal with Elizabeth? What did she do?
Yeah, you know, she never actually tried to disinherit her. She respected her father's will, and she knew that Elizabeth was going to be the next queen. And she just asked Elizabeth to honor the faith was all she did. And, I mean, I think she knew that it was going to end. Something else about that's interesting about the burning or the killing all the Protestants is that at the time the sentencing or the when somebody was convicted of heresy, they had to be sentenced by the state. It moved from an ecclesiastical church court to the state court because the church couldn't put people to death officially. And so it moved over to this. So if you were convicted of heresy, you were automatically then put into the state system. And heresy was punishable by burning. They actually thought it was like a merciful punishment because you tasted the fires of hell while you still had time to repent. So if you think, talk about reconsidering, if you reconsider that.
Wow.
They actually thought it was, you know, good because it was giving people a chance to repent before they actually tasted the real fires of hell. Which would be eternal. These fires of hell last for, you know, 45 minutes.
Oh, man.
And to a degree, you can say, yeah, I mean, I get it, kind of. But, like, my own opinion there is, like, okay, yeah, humanity can make progress, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, so I feel like Eric and I are, if we're using sort of any reconsidered principles here, it's mainly external skepticism and detachment. Because while Eric and I both have a, you know, decent high-level understanding of how Tudor England began with Henry VII and then lasted until the Stuarts, we're not really, really attached to any one particular narrative because we only know so much about it.
I haven't even watched the Tudors, to be honest.
Whoa. Well, that's actually probably you know just as much as people. Did I just say that?
Oh, no. Burn. But not as much as people who listen to your podcast.
That is true.
Repeatedly. I've listened to a couple episodes, just not enough.
I have seen The Tudors, and I'm now listening to Heather's other podcast, and it's awesome. I went at one point in my mind, like, oh, man, I wonder what parts of this show is real. It'd be cool if someone told me. And then, like, several years later, the podcast just appeared out of thin air. So thank you,
Heather. Asking you shall receive. Thank you for that kind comment. I did not actually pay them to say that.
Yeah, no, seriously, I just, like the podcast.
Yeah.
Let's see.
Okay, so go on, the detachment.
So what about internal attachment?
Yeah, right. So I think because neither you nor I, Eric, have, like, a really, really emotional attachment to any one perspective or interpretation of Mary or Elizabeth, or we want to go back in time, Anne Boleyn, then it's harder for us to, well, we're not going to have emotional response to it, so it's harder for us to detach ourselves from those emotions or be skeptical of our own positions because, I mean, we should be, but we only have sort of a loose starting point anyways, right?
Yeah, I think a better example for internal detachment is Anne Boleyn, because from what little I know about Anne Boleyn is that I know that she's a sort of big symbol. Like, she's the stakes are high with Anne Boleyn, right? Like, you either love her or hate her.
Right.
She's a big symbol of either being, like, kind of a nasty, like, stole Henry kind of woman, or a strong feminist character that was, like, standing up for, like, herself in a time where she was super oppressed by the patriarchy. And so, like, people really care about Anne Boleyn.
Yes.
But I don't know much about Anne Boleyn, so could you tell me about Anne Boleyn?
Well, her father is a diplomat. Henry had had an affair with her sister as well before, and possibly her mother. The sources vary. And anyway, she was initially kind of put into this, and she caught Henry's eye, and he wanted her. But Anne had also seen what had happened to her sister when her sister Mary had been Henry's mistress, and she was just kind of cast aside afterwards, and when Henry tired of her, which wasn't necessarily a bad thing. You could make a good marriage then. It was actually, I think, kind of if you got the king's mistress, it was kind of cool, you know. So the man who married her might have been like, oh, you know, I got the king's mistress.
Yeah, she's at least got some ears in court.
Yeah. But, you know, I think Anne didn't necessarily want to go down that route, but Anne also had her own axes to grind because Anne was meant to be engaged to somebody else. I have to look it up. I forget his exact name. But Wolsey had thwarted her engagement to this other minor nobleman, Cardinal Wolsey. And so she had this whole axe to grind against Wolsey and against, you know, what had been done to her before. So she had her own kind of things going on, but she was very educated. She was raised at the court of Margaret of Austria, which was interestingly where some of the writings of Christina of Pisan were found, who was an early feminist writer.
Oh, cool.
She wrote a book called about something about the city of ladies, about a city that was run only by ladies and what that was like. And she was a very early feminist writer of the early 15th century, I think.
Cool.
And,
wow.
Yeah. And anyway, Anne was raised around all of this culture, and she was a very cultured woman, very smart, just very charming. And, you know, I think beyond that, I don't know, you know, this whole narrative that she stole Henry or that she didn't. She, once she caught the king's eye, what are you going to do? You know, like, yeah. And she could have gone and been his mistress and then been cast away, or she could have played the role that she played. I'm not really sure what other options she would have had at that point.
So would I be correct in saying that one narrative, one interpretation that exists about Anne Boleyn then is she stole Henry from Catherine, she ruined the monarchy, she destroyed Catholicism, mm-hmm. and led to the rise of Anglican Church. Mm-hmm. And how dare she? It's all her fault. That might be right. One position, right?
Yeah.
Some people perhaps think that. If you were to approach that with internal skepticism, maybe if you're reading an article that presents some more depth, or you're listening to the Renaissance English podcast that presents some more depth, mm-hmm. and you hear something that challenges that narrative, the first thing that might happen to you is go, I don't know, that sounds like nonsense, right? Because uh-huh. it would be a fact that, if correct, kind of conflicts with your interpretation of history.
Right.
So the first thing that I would do if I ran into that emotion would be to say, okay, is that a reasonable emotion that I'm having mm-hmm. right now? Or is this something that I should actually listen to more mm-hmm. because it's causing sort of this, you know, this stirring of you know, tension or whatnot? Mm-hmm. So that would be one example of, like, internal detachment. Like, being willing to have emotion in one area of your mind and being willing to nonetheless listen to ideas that challenge your own position in another.
Yeah. And so then how could we use that for modern day? So, like, Anne, it's just interesting because both Anne and Mary, I'm kind of really interested. I have a soft spot for Mary and Anne as well, because of the kind of early feminist ideas. Mary was the first queen, and she had to navigate this world while she was also having phantom pregnancies and all of this kind of stuff. And, you know, Anne, you know, was her daughter was 3 when she was beheaded, which is Hannah's age now. And I think about if they would take me and behead me and, like, you know, wondering what would happen to my daughter. She was actually largely responsible for Mary having been declared a bastard before. So she kind of had to think, well, what's going to happen to Elizabeth now that I'm being beheaded? Mm-hmm. And, you know, just thinking about going off to the tower and thinking, like, shit, maybe this wasn't the right card to have played. And, you know, I don't know, like, I guess I feel like both of these narratives around Anne, either she's great, you know, it's the whole the virgin or the whore idea. And I feel like there's got to, like, it's even nowadays, like with Hillary Clinton, you either love her or she's evil. And I just wonder how you can bring more kind of depth to, I'm sure Anne simultaneously was evil as well as good. I mean, like, everybody has that within them, right? So talk to me about that.
I think the principle that I like to take for this is, you know, so, and one of the things that we like to do on our show that I'm really impressed you did is you were able to recognize some of your internal bias, that you have a soft spot mm-hmm. because, like, of the feminist implications of some of what they did, and what that could potentially mean is that, like, some of the nasty that they might have done, you may have like missed that detail when you read about it, mm-hmm. or it may have, like, escaped your mind. You know, they may have done nasty stuff because mm-hmm. they were humans that lived some lives.
Right.
And they may have done some, you know, and if you hate them, they may have also happened to do some wonderful stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I don't know, like, Hitler was, like, allegedly very nice to puppies or something, right? Okay. Like, he was, like, really nice to dogs. I mean, that's the crazy example is that no one is bereft of some bad or good.
Right.
And when I think of trying to be internally detached, in particular about a person, is I try to not make them a symbol for something bigger. Like, they're a person that lived a life that had their own motivations, their own flaws. But I think if you, like, make Anne Boleyn, for example, if you put the stakes too high about her narrative and her story, you can get into trouble. Because if you say, for example, Anne Boleyn is, like, a champion of feminism, or, you know, downright evil and the destroyer of Catholicism, or whatever your third narrative might be,
what happens is when you see evidence that her life, that something she did in her life, like, conflicts with that narrative, mm-hmm. it's very, very hard to embrace that, right? You start to reject it. You're like, no, yeah. because she somehow symbolized this thing that she doesn't actually.
And I'm thinking about, like, putting our own filters on people. Like, we're thinking about this. Like, I showed you some of the YouTube comments that people put on. Eric was like,
we can't say this on this show without making an explicit show. It's terrible stuff.
Yeah, and it was just funny because we were talking about what to talk about. And you were like, yeah, but people don't have such emotional responses to Tudor England. Let me show you what people write on YouTube. And it's like, people are really, really into this, right? Like, have some seriously emotional investments in this. And I just think, like, we're putting our filters now 500 years later, post-women's movement, post-women being able to have the, like, we're, like, we have this whole idea of what feminism, like, for me, with that card, with that narrative, with Anne Boleyn and with Mary and Elizabeth too, but having a soft spot for them because I'm a feminist or whatever. And I, but it's like my understanding of fem, like, trying to say Anne Boleyn was a feminist is like, I don't know what a similar trying to say that, I can't even think, like, Anne Boleyn didn't know what a feminist, you know, like, Anne Boleyn didn't know that word. Right. Like, the idea that even she would, like, even Christina Pizan, The City of Ladies, like, the whole premise, it was so revolutionary because the whole premise of it was that women could not do this. And that was, like, utopia, like, doesn't exist, right? And so it's like, these people didn't think in terms of women's rights.
Right.
And so for me to say Anne Boleyn was a feminist, like, she didn't know what that meant.
Right.
Like, she wouldn't know. So that's me putting my filter on her. And so talk to me about that.
I think it's very difficult to be able to recognize your own filters, but I think doing that, especially if you're in a position of talking to more than a couple of people at a time, is attempting to be honest, because you're saying, listen, everyone, I'm going to talk about something, but just so you know, this is where I'm coming from.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Now, I think as it relates to Anne Boleyn, as it relates to, you mentioned Clinton and sort of mm-hmm. today,
mm-hmm.
the first thing that comes to my mind, if I'm thinking about these either famous figures in history or political figures, is one, we are almost certainly placing too much emphasis on a handful of people that are just better well known, right? Because I know more about Henry VIII than I do about Moore or Wolsey, just because there's probably more written about him.
Mm-hmm.
And same with today, right? You're going to read more stories in the BBC and Politico and AP about Hillary Clinton than my state senator, right, mm-hmm. in California. So the first thing that I always say to myself is, no matter what I think I know about this, it's almost certainly more complicated.
Mm-hmm.
Because Anne Boleyn was not acting in a vacuum. She mm-hmm. was acting in a really complex, dangerous political system with mm-hmm. different pressures, different actors with individual interests and motivations.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just difficult, therefore, to attribute everything to one person, because it's almost certainly more complex than mm-hmm. that.
Interesting. Well, this has been a really interesting conversation.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed it.
And just see where we're kind of going.
Yeah, I was, one of the things swirling around in my head is, you know, some of what I don't know fully how I feel about it all the time, but one of the narratives I've heard is that, you know, a lot of the criticism that Hillary Clinton gets, a man would not get.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the stuff I kind of look at and I go, like, that's possibly true. And some of the stuff I go, well, maybe not so much. Because you could make that defense of any criticism of Hillary Clinton. Like, someone mm-hmm. could plausibly say of any criticism of her, mm-hmm. well, a man wouldn't get that, so mm-hmm. it's sexism. And then there's also the narrative that there's a lot of people that wanted to vote for Hillary Clinton because she's a woman. Mm-hmm. And I've seen some of that as well. Like, mm-hmm. people are like, time for our first woman president. And you're right. Kind of like, okay, fine. You know, and so, you know, Anne Boleyn, there might be some, you know, if you look back in Anne Boleyn, there might be some similar stuff where, like, maybe if you dug up something, it's like, look, Anne Boleyn schemed. She was a schemer. Mm-hmm. It's like, dude, this is freaking Tudor England. Everyone schemed, mate. Like, everyone was scheming.
This is the Tudor court. It was nothing but scheming.
Yes, it was scheming 100% of the time, all the time.
Uh-huh.
And is there a reason that you're upset that Anne Boleyn schemed when you're not upset that all these other people are running around scheming politically?
Yeah.
And at the same time, are there some places that Anne Boleyn would get a pass if, you know, versus someone else because she's a woman by a different kind of person?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, obviously the gender is still a, you know, even though we're past the women's movement, gender is still a, it's a pretty hot thing. And mm-hmm. I think one of the internal skepticisms that we can have, and maybe that's the only one we didn't hit, I'm not sure, that we can have is, you know, we have implicit narratives that we do apply to men and women differently, mm-hmm. like the scheming thing, like, mm-hmm. oh, this man is you know, a clever manipulator versus this schemy woman. Stuff like that.
There's a woman, Bess of Hardwick, who was this woman who rose from being a yeoman gentry family through marriages and being clever and fighting for her dower rights and all this. She became the second wealthiest woman in England just after Elizabeth. And she also was a dynasty builder because she married her children off to advantageous marriages. And she wound up, her granddaughter had a claim to the throne, which had she been a man, she probably would have been king over James I of Scotland. Wow. Her daughter Arbella, who was just as viable of a claim to the throne. And that was through Bess of Hardwick's marrying her children off to these different people. Anyway, it's funny because people talk about Bess of Hardwick and say, oh, she was a dynasty builder. Like, it's a bad thing. Whereas, like, Henry VII was a dynasty builder, right? But people, with even contemporary, would say, you know, this woman is just scheming for her children. That's all the men did, too. Right. Like, that's what you did. Yeah. You schemed for your children. Like, that was the whole point.
Yeah.
And it's just interesting when you talked about that.
Like, yeah. And I'm sure we could find tons of examples. And it would seem the case, I think, when we think about Hillary Clinton, we can't deny that all of us, I think, when we look at her, think of her differently and kind of apply different filters to her, whether rosy or black or some mix of it, in a different way than we would were it Barack Obama running or, you know, Bernie Sanders or something like that.
Yeah.
So we need to...
Right. Yeah. Well, I guess, we could go on for a long time. So if you want to hear more of these kinds of discussions... you need to check out these guys' podcast, Reconsider. So do you guys want to plug it again?
ReconsiderMedia.com/podcast. Come check out Reconsider, where we pick one interesting topic twice a month. We'll talk about it. We'll help you with the research, but we won't do the thinking for you.
Yep. You can also find us on your favorite podcatcher. You can find us on social media at ReconsiderPod, both Facebook and Twitter. We tend to get even sillier than we did with Heather. We have a lot of fun. Our audience has a lot of fun. We'd love for you guys to get involved. Ask us some questions. Let us know what you'd love us to talk about on our next show or probably some shows down the line. Also check out Watching the Tudors with Heather. But we hope to see you over there. We hope to hear from you as well.
Yeah.
Thanks for having us on your show.
Thanks for coming on my show. Thanks for coming to Spain.
Yeah, we're in Ronda right now with Heather, and it's a ton of fun.
Vale.
Vale. It's been amazing.
Adios.
All right, see you, everyone.
Feliz Navidad. Bye-bye.
Blow, northern wind, a scent will make me sweating. Blow, northern wind, blow, blow, blow. Ich hörte Bord in Bauerbrick, at Sol ist am Lieson See.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
it. Coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.